Well, as I mentioned this morning, we're going to be looking at the fact that there is no right way to do a wrong thing. Now, there are many wrong ways to do a thing that could have been done right. We do that all the time. We take a lot of good things, right things, and corrupt them or abuse them in some way or another. And there are several ways that we could do that. We may do the right thing, but with the wrong attitude. If so, we're not really doing the right thing anymore. We may do the right action, but for the wrong reason. And if so, we're not really doing the right thing. We may do the proper thing, or even call it the proper thing, but do it in the wrong way and not be doing the right thing. So there are many ways, and there are probably other ways that perhaps you can think of, that we can take something that is right and good and corrupt it or ruin it. But there is no way that we can take something that is wrong and make it right. And yet that's what a lot of us try to do from time to time. We try to convince ourselves that the wrong thing that we're doing is okay for one reason or another. Psalm 50 in verses 16 through 23. Unto the wicked God says, what have you to do to declare my statutes, or that you should take my covenant in your mouth, seeing you hate instruction and cast my words behind you? When you saw a thief, then you consented with him, and have partaken with adulterers. You give your mouth to evil, and your tongue frames deceit. You sit and speak against your brother. You slander your own mother's son. These things you have done, and I kept silent. You thought that I was altogether such an one as you. But I will reprove you and set them in order before your eyes. Now consider this, you that forget God, lest I tear you in pieces and there be none to deliver. Whoso offers praise glorifies me, and to him that orders his conversation aright will I show the salvation of God. So God makes it clear that if you're doing these wicked things, then He is against you. But notice what He says there. He says, I kept silent, and you thought that I was one like you. I was one such as yourself. And that's the tendency we have. We tend to paint God in the image of ourselves. And we tend to think that if we can somehow justify it to ourselves, whatever it is we're doing, that then we would be able to justify it to God and He'll understand. But it doesn't work that way. There is no right way to do a wrong thing. And we're going to look at a few examples. We won't spend a lot of time on them, but we just want to hammer these home a little bit. There's no right way to be engaged in sex outside of marriage. In Genesis chapter 39 and verse 9, Joseph was being tempted by his master's wife. He said, there is none greater in this house than I, neither has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Somebody said, well, he didn't like her, and that's why he didn't want to be with her. But if he had loved her, then it would have been okay, wouldn't it? I mean, if they really loved each other, that would have been okay. Doesn't work that way. It doesn't matter. People all the time are engaged in all sorts of wicked sexuality, and they'll sometimes have made arrangements with their spouse that, well, we just understand that we kind of have an open relationship and we're still married, but he sees other women and I see other men. And they think that because they have this understanding, that God's going to understand that too. Notice what Genesis 16:5 says. You remember the story of Sarah and Abraham? And Abram and Sarai could not have a child, and so Sarai gave Hagar to Abraham. Notice what chapter 16 and verse 5 says. After all of that had taken place, Sarai said to Abram, "My wrong be upon you. I have given my maid into your bosom, and when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes." Sarah realized a little too late that what she thought was going to work out, this is a great plan. It wasn't God's plan. It wasn't what God wanted. But she thought it was going to work out. This is going to be the way we're going to solve this problem. And it did not solve problems. In fact, it only created more problems. And do you realize that to this day, some 4,000 years later, our world is still in turmoil, suffering the effects of the sin that Abraham and Sarah committed by not trusting God and by sending Hagar into him instead? The turmoil in the Middle East, the descendants of Ishmael that are just tumultuous in that region as a result of this situation where somebody thought, well, it's okay, you know, we'll do this other way and it'll work out. It won't work out. God has said that sex outside of marriage is wrong, and there is no right way to do that. All of the arguments that all of, well, we'll have safe sex. Doesn't matter. It's still not right. There is no right way to be engaged in sex outside of marriage. There is no right way to be engaged in vengeful retaliation. We're tempted sometimes. Romans 12, verses 19 through 21, Paul says, "Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord.' Therefore, if your enemy hungers, feed him. If he thirsts, give him drink. For in so doing, you shall heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good." Paul tells us there's not a right way to avenge yourself. You leave that up to God. Instead, what we ought to be doing is heaping those coals of fire on their heads. But we say, in the court system allows me. I know it wouldn't be right for me to do something mean to them, but I'll take them to court and we'll let the courts decide it. 1 Corinthians 6:7-8 says, "Now therefore there is utterly a fault among you because you go to law with one with another. Why do you not rather take the wrong? Why do you not rather suffer yourselves to be defrauded? No, you do wrong and you defraud, and that your brethren." Paul makes it clear there's no right way to go about being vengeful and trying to retaliate against someone else. There's no right way to do that. Oh, there may be in any particular society a legal way to do it. But just because man considers something legal does not mean that God considers that thing moral. And we live under God's law, not just man's law. We must answer to God. He also in Colossians 3 and then Hebrews 10, Colossians 3, 23 through 25, and Hebrews 10, 30 and 31 talks about this vengeance that belongs to God, and that we should not be taking this in our own hands. The third thing that we want to notice is that there is no right way to be engaged in the taking of an innocent life. There's no right way to do that. We have all sorts of laws that try to get around that. We have all sorts of words to change something from being what it is. We say that that unborn child isn't really a child. We call it a fetus, or we'll call it a clump of cells, or we'll call it a growth, but not a child. Proverbs 6, verses 16 and 17, the Bible says, "These six things does the Lord hate. A seven are an abomination unto Him: a proud look, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood," is the third one in that list of seven. Hands that shed innocent blood. The Lord hates that. There's no good way to go about doing it. Jeremiah 22:3 says, "Execute judgment and righteousness, and deliver the spoiled out of the hand of the oppressor, and do no wrong. Do no violence to the stranger, the fatherless, nor the widow, neither shed innocent blood in this place." Now, of course, we understand when we say taking an innocent life, we're not talking about capital punishment. We're not talking about the execution of the wicked by the justice system that we have in place. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about innocent life. We're talking about someone who did not deserve to die. Exodus 23:7. And Psalms 106 and verse 38 also bear out this idea that you can't take innocent life and be held guiltless before God for that. Then the fourth thing that we want to notice is that there is no right way to be engaged in supporting sinful behavior. You know, how many times do we do things in support of something that we say, "Well, I would never do it myself. I wouldn't do it. I know I shouldn't do that." But then we support that activity through our actions, through our finances sometimes. And we support the wickedness that's in the world around us. Romans 1, 28 through 32. God describes here a group of people that didn't like to retain Him in their knowledge. And so He gave them over to do things which were not right, were not convenient, the King James says. But verse 29 says that those individuals became filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness. They were full of envy and murder and debate and deceit and malignity and whisperers and backbiters and haters of God. They were despiteful, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to their parents, without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, implacable, unmerciful. That sounds like a pretty horrible group. We say, "Whoa, I'd never be involved with that. I wouldn't do those things." But be careful, because if you're supporting people who are doing those things, you're supporting those things that they're doing. You may be becoming a partaker of their evil deeds. Notice verse 32 then. He says, "Who, knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them." Now, we just talked a little while ago about the fact that there's no right way to be engaged in sex outside of marriage. And yet, in so much of the music and television and movies and other things in our society that are portrayed to us, sex outside of marriage is glorified. It's a good thing. It's the way to go. And when we watch that, buy tickets to go see movies with that, buy CDs or tapes of music that glorifies those things, then we're supporting those things. We're saying that even though, well, I wouldn't do it, but I'll gladly watch someone else do it. I'll gladly pay for someone else to do it, but I would never do it myself. Not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. If we have pleasure in those who are doing these same things that we listed here, that are engaged in fornication, and we enjoy that, we have pleasure in those things. We have pleasure in those who murder. And then you say, well, you know, in the movies, they're not really doing those things. It's all for pretend. Well, what happened to avoid the appearance of evil? To pretend to do those things? Make it look as realistically as possible as though we're doing those things? Well, we need to avoid those things. Ephesians 5:11 tells us to have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them. 2 John 1:9-11 says, whoever transgresses and abides not in the doctrine of Christ has not God. He that abides in the doctrine of Christ has both the Father and the Son. If there come any unto you and bring not this doctrine, receive him not into your house, neither bid him Godspeed. For he that bids him Godspeed is partaker of his evil deeds. If a false teacher came to town and wanted to hold a tent meeting, would you put him up in your house? And say, oh, stay at my house. I'll feed you and make sure you've got a place to stay. Well, if you did something like that, you would be partaking in his evil deeds. Well, what if that was someone that came to you and said, well, I think that we should fight for the right for homosexual marriage. And he said, well, you can stay at my house and I'll take care of you and I'll feed you and give you a place to stay. Then we've become a protector of those evil deeds. Anything that's contrary to the doctrine of Christ that we support, we become a partaker in those evil deeds. We become a supporter of that. Just as when we support mission work, we become a partaker in those labors. So, if we support wickedness, we become a partaker in that. We need to consider what we're doing. Revelation 18:4, a voice from heaven said, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins. God has called us to be separate from the world. But so many times, we blur the lines. The fifth thing that we want to consider is that there's no right way to be involved in lying, gossiping, filthy communication, misusing the name of God, or any number of other abuses of the tongue. There's no right way to do that. Ephesians 4:29 says, let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace to the hearers. How often do we allow corrupt communication to come out of our mouths, though? I'm sure that it's more often than we should. Even if it's only once, it's more often than we should. One of the most common things we do is throw God's name around very lightly. But Jesus said when he was teaching his disciples how to pray in Matthew 6 and verse 9, that you should pray in this manner, our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be your name. You know what the word hallowed means? Hallowed means holy and special and set apart and something that is certainly not thrown around lightly. It's something that is admired and revered. And yet we throw God's name around. We don't hallow it. We take it very lightly. Ephesians 4:25 says, put away lying, speak truth with your neighbor. Ephesians 5, 3 through 7 has a list of filthiness and foolish talking or jesting, which are not convenient. And he gives us the alternative, but rather giving of thanks. And in Ephesians 4:29, he said, you'll use those things that are good to edify, build up. We need to be saying things that are positive and helpful and encouraging and teaching. Those are the things that ought to be coming out of our mouths. Right. Not things that tear down and destroy and hurt others. There is no right way for us to be engaged in hatred of our fellow man. And it's difficult sometimes because people do horrible things to one another, and sometimes those people do horrible things to us. But we have an example. Jesus was treated as horribly as any of us could ever imagine being treated. But he did not harbor any hatred for those, even those who did those things to him. Even those who were responsible for those things being done to him. Matthew 5, 43 and 44, he says, you have heard that it has been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. And that's hard. There are some things in Christianity that aren't really that difficult for most of us. I don't know about you. I've never found it that difficult not to murder. I know some people have a real struggle with that, but I've never found that to be that difficult. But to be angry with someone and to want to just hate them, you know what John says? In 1 John chapter 3 and verse 15, John says, whosoever hates his brother is a murderer. So maybe I have been tempted to murder someone. I may not have followed through with it with the physical action, but in my heart, if I hated that person, I had the heart of a murderer, even if I didn't have the hands of a murderer. John also tells us, he that hates his brother is in darkness. He says, if a man says, I love God, and hates his brother, he's a liar. There's no room for hatred in the Christian life. And then the seventh thing that we want to notice is that there is no right way to be engaged in destructive habits. 1 Corinthians 6, 19 and 20, Paul says, what? Know ye not that your body is the temple of the Holy Ghost which is in you, which ye have of God, and you are not your own? For you are bought with a price. Therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. Basically what Paul tells us is our body and our spirit belong to God. And we better take care of them as good stewards should. Because they don't belong to us. People say, well, it's my life. No, it's not. It's God's. It's not your life. Well, it's my body. No, it's not. It's God's. When we engage in destructive habits, we get ourselves into all kinds of troubles. But Romans 12:1 tells us what we ought to do instead. I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. This is our purpose, to serve God with our body, soul, and spirit. And we cannot do that if we are engaged in all kinds of destructive habits. The eighth thing that we want to look at. We're coming toward the end. I know you don't believe it, but we are. It is impossible for us to be right and be engaged in lawlessness. There are a lot of people that in spiritual matters, they want to say, well, it's all grace, 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 there's no law. Paul said, to those without the law, I became as without the law, though not being without law unto God, but under the law of Christ. There is a law. We do have a law to follow spiritually. The same thing is true in the physical realm. We are to follow the law. Romans 13:1-6, Paul says, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. Do you realize what Paul is telling us here? He says if we rebel against the governing authorities, God will condemn us because we're rebelling against His ordinance. Now, we understand, of course, that if the law of the land conflicts with the law of God, we will always follow the law of God. In that case, we're not the ones rebelling. The government is the one rebelling. But in the absence of that occasion, and as far as I know, at this point in time, none of our laws demand of us to be disobedient to God in any way, we are to subject ourselves to the ruling authorities. And to fail to do so puts us in a position where if we are resisting, no, we understand all of us may do something, you know, come over the top of a hill and we get going too fast down it. We don't slow down fast enough when we see the 35-mile-an-hour speed limit sign coming into a town. We understand, you know, and when we do that and we see those little blue flashing lights, it reminds us that we shouldn't have been doing that. But there is a difference in an occasional slip-up in those ways and in resisting and rebelling and being people of lawlessness. You see, there are people who practice lawlessness. They go out of their way to try to break every law they can. They're happy when they break laws. And God condemns that. He goes on to say, for rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and you shall have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to you for good. But if you do that which is evil, be afraid. For he bears not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger, to execute wrath upon him that does evil. So he tells us that God put that government in place. Sometimes it's a good government. Sometimes it's not a good government. But we need to keep in mind that the government that was in place at the time when Paul wrote this, the Roman government, was one of the most corrupt governments in history. And one of the most wicked. The emperors considered themselves to be gods. They thought that they had the power of God, and they were persecuting Christians. And yet Paul didn't say, run away or rebel or try to overthrow the government. Instead, he said, you be subject to them. If you'll be subject to them, they won't be a terror to good works. It's hard to believe that he could write that at a time when the government was persecuting the faith. But then we want to look at the final thing, number 9. There is no right way to be engaged in theft. And we say, I'm not a thief. I don't know when to steal anything. Oh, really? Because I think sometimes we are thieves without realizing we're thieves or without considering ourselves thieves. Exodus 22:2-4 says, if a thief be found breaking up and be smitten that he die, there shall no blood be shed for him. If the sun be risen upon him, there shall be blood shed for him, for he should make full restitution. If he have nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. If the theft be certainly found in his hand alive, whether it be ox or ass or sheep, he shall restore double. Do you realize that God authorized under the Old Testament law that if you stole something and then you couldn't pay for it, why, they'd just sell you. That's pretty rough, isn't it? You better hope if you stole something that you had the money. But if you had the money, why did you steal it in the first place? Most of the time people stole because they didn't have. In another place, Jeremiah 22, 13 and 14 says, "Woe unto him that builds his house by unrighteousness and his chambers by wrong, that uses his neighbor's service without wages and gives him not for his work." You realize that when we take advantage of someone and don't pay them a fair wage, we're a thief. We're robbing that individual when we do that. Proverbs 6 and verse 30 and 31, Solomon says, "Men do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy his soul when he is hungry." And we understand that, you know, if somebody's starving and they steal a loaf of bread, we still acknowledge that it's wrong, but we don't despise that person the way we would despise somebody like Bernie Madoff, who just made off with everybody's money and didn't need to, wasn't starving. But he goes on to say, if he be found, he shall restore sevenfold. He shall give all the substance of his house. Well, that's something. Back in Exodus, if they found him with it, he was going to have to pay double. Now here we are in Proverbs. This is kind of the progression of the way governments work. At first he had to pay double. Now Solomon says, hey, if he gets caught stealing, he's going to have to pay seven times back. He's going to have to return sevenfold. Proverbs 29, verse 24, Solomon also records, "Whosoever is partner with a thief hates his own soul." 1 Peter 4:15 says, "But let none of you suffer as a murderer, or as a thief, or as an evildoer, or as a busybody in other men's matters." You know, sometimes we excuse any number of these things. We excuse the lying and the gossiping and the taking of the Lord's name in vain. And we say, well, you know, that's not a big deal. It's not important. Or we say, well, it just slipped out. It was just an accident. Or we say, well, that's a little white lie. Or we say, I wasn't really gossiping. I was just expressing my concern about the situation. You know, we come up with all sorts of different ways to say it so that it doesn't sound so bad. We say, well, I wasn't really stealing from my employer. They owed me. And so when I took that ream of paper or those pens or that notebook or whatever I took from my employer, I wasn't stealing. They owed me that. And we need to understand with all of these things, whether it's the vengeful retaliation, or whether it's supporting sinful behavior, whatever it is in any of these categories, we can make all the excuses we want to. They will never justify us before God. In fact, the only way that we will ever be able to be right with God is if we will quit trying to justify it and excuse it and admit it, confess it, repent of it, and get back to doing what we should be doing, obeying God. We need to be sure that that's the path that we take. If you're here this evening and you have a need to respond to the invitation, perhaps you find yourself being caught up in some of these things and excusing yourself and saying, well, I'm not as bad as so-and-so over there. I don't gossip as much as so-and-so. I don't lie as often as so-and-so. I may hold a grudge, but I would never really hurt them. Or, well, you know, God's restrictions on this sex thing are just too much. I'm not a bad person. I really love that person that I was with, and it should be okay. We can come up with as many sins as there are. There's that many excuses for why we commit them. But we need to get out and get away from those excuses and accept responsibility for the fact that we disobeyed God, and admit that we need His forgiveness. And we need His strength to help us overcome the temptations that Satan sets before us. If you're here and you have a need to respond for any reason, we ask that you do so as we stand and as we sing.